Next, please welcome Dr. William Van Cleve. He spoke to the society, he tells me, years ago, but in a sense is a newcomer to our midst, certainly compared to the other two panelists we have this afternoon. Dr. Van Cleve is a professor at Southwest Missouri State University in Springfield, Missouri, and director of its Center for Defense and Strategic Studies, and also a senior research fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution. He is the author and co-author of many publications on strategic defense, and he tells me has been most recently concerned with matters relating to the breakup of the former Soviet Union and events in the Middle East. Also, years ago, he was a member of the first American delegation to the SALT talks and directed the Department of Defense transition from the Carter to the Reagan administrations. Soon after that, went back to the University of Southern California, and he says after 20 years in California, that was enough. He found his way back to the Midwest, where he still resides and teaches. Please welcome Dr. Bill Van Cleve.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here. I don't know what to say about having my topic sandwiched between natural and divine law. Churchill spoke of the necessity in war of surrounding the truth with a bodyguard of lies. It seems to me that our schedule turns that around and we're surrounding a lie with a bodyguard of truths. My subject is treaty law, but treaty law, whether it's regarded as the law of treaties or the law to be derived from treaties, is too vast and complicated to try to cover. And fortunately, Forrest MacDonald has thoroughly covered international law and the sources of international law, whether power or voluntary. So I'm going to focus on arms control and arms control treaties and raise, but undoubtedly not answer, the question of whether there is an existing system of law based on such agreements. And in doing this, I'm going to be looking at practice rather than what is desirable or what might be. The laws of international society, it seems to me, are determined by the nature and practice of things, not necessarily by the words of treaties or agreements. And I hope to show that. I'm focusing on arms control treaties and agreements because both during the Cold War and after it, the United States security policy has heavily emphasized the putative benefits of arms control, whether bilateral or multilateral. Obviously, I'm not in addressing arms control agreements and treaties. I'm certainly not talking about the great bulk of international law, which exists because it reflects identical or complementary interests, and which hardly needs any enforcement at all because it is observed in the interests of the parties to it. At the foundation of a system of laws, there's a body of norms and of ethical and political principles. And the intelligibility of such a system depends on an understanding of those fundamental principles and morals. In international relations and international law, however, it is very questionable whether there is such a body of agreed principles, and to the extent that it does exist, it is always subject to what Thucydides called the pressure of necessity, when the strong take what they can and the weak grant what they must. Governments that are not based on democratic principles and the rule of law are always ready, when it suits their interests, to discard the restraints that international treaties have on their foreign policy and their military actions, to evade legal obligations that are harmful to their ambitions, to use the imprecision and lack of enforcement of arms control treaties to further their own ends, and generally use these treaties to promote interests not in accord with the treaties or with the law. Do these treaties then constitute law for the parties to them? Well, it all depends. In the case of the United States, of course they do. Our Constitution makes that unquestionable. In fact, our very values make our fealty to arms control treaties and agreements so great that we often overcomply with them to the extent that the indirect constraints of arms control agreements, that is to say, those that we deem implied by the agreements, are frequently more stringent and constraining than the literal or legal terms of the agreements. The ABM Treaty has been a clear example of that. We have not done in missile defense what it legally allows us to do. We have not taken the liberties with the agreement that the Soviet Union and now Russia has taken. And the present administration is in the process of extending that treaty to areas it was never intended to cover, such as theater missile defenses. One of the major problems with modern arms control agreements is that they are freely circumvented or violated. If rules of international law are consistently violated, and if these violations are accepted as a matter of course by all of the subjects to it, if therefore the legal rules are treated by those who ought to enforce them as if they did not exist, the question arises, do they still exist as binding legal rules? Eugene Rostow, in his recent fine book, Managing Peace, or with a better title as published by the National Defense University, A Breakfast for Bonaparte, writes, no statement can be considered a norm of law unless it is effectively enforced. That is, unless the political system responds to a breach of the purported norm by genuinely attempting to enforce it. A proposition can be considered a legal norm even if it is not universally respected and enforced, but it cannot be considered a norm of law if respect and enforcement are the exception rather than the rule. I submit that this is the case when it comes to arms control agreements today. Arms control agreements truly embody the pithy description of international law once given by Israel's ambassador to the UN, Abba Eban, when he said that international law is that which the wicked do not obey and the righteous do not enforce. Obviously, the identical text of arms control agreements can have very different interpretations and legal meanings according to the political, cultural, and legal views of the various parties to the agreement, as well as to the power at their command. It is not too cynical, I believe, to suggest, however, that this is deliberate, that disguising reality in ambiguous language is frequently the price of gaining a treaty. Getting an agreement in the West is deemed so important that persistent differences are often simply concealed in language treaty. During the SALT negotiations, SALT I and SALT II, and the START negotiations, in almost every case, the language is compromised solutions. The language of the treaties have been more often generalized and left vague in an effort to make it appear that some degree of agreement or understanding had in fact been reached, when in fact they were worded so as to permit each side to interpret the language of the treaty to suit its own purposes. An examination of the official negotiating record of these agreements would reveal that the United States and the Soviet Union and now Russia attach widely opposing views as to the meanings of the words. Soviet and Russian negotiators went to great pains to avoid precise definitions and concrete terms. They sought wording which would appear to satisfy us, but still permit them their own interpretations. This, of course, raises great questions as to what compliance with these agreements really mean and what, in fact, are violations of the agreement. We have twisted our own selves around these terms and have argued incessantly over the issue of compliance and violation. I might say before addressing this, however, that whether these agreements can be verified as to compliance is in fact a secondary issue to the nature of the agreements themselves. A good contract can be debased by cheating, but a bad one cannot be redeemed by faithful compliance. In my view as well, arms control treaties are particularly subject to the law of unintended consequences. This was certainly so, for example, with the naval arms control agreements between World War I and World War II, and it is so with the START I and START II agreements today that we expect Russia to comply with. These treaties, intended to reduce substantially the offensive nuclear arms of the parties, the United States and the Soviet Union and now Russia, in effect, simply allow Russia to remain an equal nuclear superpower at levels it can easily afford and maintain despite its economic difficulties. And when it is considered that thanks to our allegiance to the ABM Treaty compared to Russia's calculated disregard of it, Russia has national missile defenses and we do not, in overall strategic terms, arms control agreements that exist today will help Russia remain strategically superior in nuclear forces to the United States. One of the unpleasant facts about contemporary arms control treaties is not only that they are unverifiable, ineffective, and unenforceable, but that they are used deliberately by parties to the agreement as protective cover for programs in violation of the agreement. Take the Non-Proliferation Treaty and the current Conventional Weapons Convention for which Congress held hearings last month. Not only can we not verify them, that is, we can have no confidence that treaty parties do not have clandestine programs or even stockpile of weapons, but we know that some governments will sign the agreements expressly to help conceal the real intentions and activities contrary to the agreements. Just as the Soviet Union regarded the SALT and START agreements, and I believe Russia today regards START I and START II, arms control negotiations and treaties are seen as ways to pursue adversarial objectives and strategic advantages by means short of armed conflict that are cloaked in the cloth of law. The fundamental problem here, of course, is a problem of the difference in political cultures and the great difference between democratic states and non-democratic states. We should always remember the asymmetry of arms control between democratic states and authoritarian ones. Arms are always controlled in the West. We do not need agreements to control and limit arms. Our basic societal values constitute strong pressures to limit to the lowest level of military forces and armaments possible in times of peace. We are forever asking ourselves how much is enough or how little is enough. Our institutions work toward the controlling of arms. Our democratic processes do as well. Public opinion, the media, our legislative and budgetary processes all control arms in ways not present in non-democratic societies. These things we should remember as well as we possibly can. Authoritarian powers, without exception, persistently have cheated at the margins of behavior permitted by arms control regimes, and Western democracies have never designed and executed a compliance policy to enforce that compliance. Let me take you through history a little bit and remind you of the case of the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union systematically circumvented the arms agreements that we negotiated with them. Generally, the Soviet arms control policy, as the policy of many other countries today, was to avoid limitations that in fact restricted its arms plans and programs. When otherwise desirable limits occurred because of their effect on the United States, but threatened to contain their behavior, they have been careful to insist on wording that preserves the illusion of control while actually leaving them literally unconstrained. The U.S. government, of course, abetted this behavior by accepting loopholes and ambiguous language in the agreements, and then downplaying or ignoring these loopholes and ambiguities in their eagerness to sell the agreements to Congress and the public, and then resorted to taking a very literal and legal approach to the question of compliance. Consequently, it led to a situation where the President of the United States finally issued formal findings of Soviet noncompliance with existing arms control agreements to the point, as Ronald Reagan said, it left the United States in unilateral compliance with these agreements. This, I submit, does not describe a system of laws. And in conclusion, I would like to make several points. First, the basic truth of our time about arms control treaties is that they have become protective covers for unlawful activities. They are used by the parties to them for deceptive purposes, and the law deriving from them is essentially that weak. Arms control agreements are designed to work principally where there are no real problems. Where there are no real problems, arms control agreements can be temporarily effective, but they are unnecessary. When there are real problems, they are necessary but not likely to be effective. I call your attention again to the Non-Proliferation Treaty and to the Chemical Weapons Convention. Where there are real problems of nuclear weapons proliferation, the Non-Proliferation Treaty is helpless. Where there are real programs of chemical weapons capabilities, the Conventional Weapons Convention will also be helpless. Hence, arms control treaties tend to work best where they aren't needed. This leads to the final observation about these agreements. No arms control treaty, no language of the treaty, can be considered in isolation from the political and power context of the agreements and the ambitions of the parties to those agreements. Those seem to be obvious truths. They're simple enough, but they're frequently forgotten. And they're usually forgotten by the government in the negotiation of these agreements, and they're usually overlooked by the Congress of the United States when it examines these agreements and gets lost in a forest of technical details and legalities and the like. In fact, what we have in front of us is a very questionable regime of international law based upon arms control agreements, and in prospect a continued situation where the United States and the Western democracies will probably remain in unilateral compliance with agreements that other nations will not observe. Thank you.